Hello and welcome to Politico's 2016 Nerdcast, where we bring you the stories behind the stories and geek out on this amazing circus of an election. It's Thursday, October 27th, and I'm Kristen Roberts, National Editor. Here are the numbers that mattered this week. 150. That's the number of electoral votes that were cast as too close to call in a recent Trump campaign email. 40, the number of national polls conducted in October, and Donald Trump only led in four of them. 0, the number of fundraisers Trump victory plans between now and Election Day. And 3, the number of GOP House incumbents whose seats are now leaning Democratic or even worse in the Cook Political Report. So grab your calculators and enjoy a rather heated week on the 2016 Nerdcast. Here we go again. Hello, Charlie Matessian.
Hi, Kristen.
Scott Bland, hi.
Hello, Kristen.
Ken Vogel, hello out there.
Hey.
And welcome back from the trail, Eli Stokels.
Good to be back.
I think I believe you. We've got another great question from a listener. Let's everybody say hi to Carla from New York. Hi, Carla.
Hey, Carla.
Hi.
What's your question, Carla?
My question is, I'm wondering who counts the early voting ballots, when they are counted, and when these results are released.
Thank you. Charlie?
It's a really timely question. I actually got one from a good friend of mine back home, that same exact question this morning from a good friend back home. And the way it works, it's a little confusing because if you look at the media stories about early voting, you'd think that the race is close to decided, and that we have all this information about the head start on the elections and who's up and who's down. But the truth is, we don't know. For all the coverage, we have no idea because they're not counted yet. In most of every state, they don't count them till Election Day. Now, the rules are different state by state, just the nature of our decentralized system. All of our election rules differ state by state, whether it's something as random as whether you can take ballot selfies, or the degree to which they allow early voting, the duration of it, the hours of the polls. All of that differs by state. But one thing that seems pretty uniform is that they don't get counted until Election Day, various times. Some of them start it in the morning. Others do it midday. Others do it when the polls close. So then you wonder, well, what about all this coverage of early voting and things look good for Democrats and things like that? What's going on here is that we don't have results because they're not counted by election administrators. But what these stories are telling people is our best guess based on who is returning the ballots, meaning we don't know who they voted for, but we do know in some states, because some states provide fantastic information about who is asking for ballots, who is returning them. Some states will tell you even the gender of the people who have asked for ballots or returned the ballots. And so all the stories you read are based on those kinds of percentages, meaning we know that more Democrats than usual may have asked for an absentee ballot in one state than in the past. And that's probably a pretty good sign for Democrats. Or if there is a really, really big absentee vote return in a place like Iowa, we know in the past that's been pretty good for Republicans. And so we extrapolate from that and guess that, hey, that's probably pretty promising for Republicans. So that's sort of the heart of what you're seeing in these stories. It's mostly guesswork based on data that doesn't know the outcome and the results of these ballots, but is guessing about who's requesting and returning them.
Carla, thanks so much for listening and for your email.
Thank you.
Let's get to our first data point, 150. That's the number of electoral votes that were characterized as too close to call in a recent Trump campaign email. Now, this assessment seems to bear no relationship to national or battleground state polls. Charlie, please help us understand. What does Trump think is in play, and what is really in play?
Yeah, I thought that that email was pretty fascinating. And what it was a map, the red and blue map of the U.S. And then it had the 11 battleground states that I think most people can agree on were colored out as gray, as too close to call, as if, all of these battleground states are still too close to call, when the reality is nothing like that. The reality is probably half the battleground states are pretty much cooked right now. And among their gray states that were grayed out as sort of too close to call is place like Michigan, which almost no one thinks is in play. And then Wisconsin, same thing. And then there's some other states that I think are arguable, but they're probably too far gone right now. You know, one state that the Trump campaign continues to talk about, and it was also listed as too close to call on this map, is Pennsylvania. Now, Pennsylvania, you may have seen the poll that came out today, Hillary Clinton up 7. That makes 29 consecutive public polls in Pennsylvania with Hillary Clinton in the lead. So, you know, you tell me, is that a competitive too close to call state? I don't think so. But what it does tell you is that, you know, they're trying to fight back against the narrative that the race is over. But also, I think it shows a sort of a strategic dissonance at Trump Tower because...
Wait. Strategic and Trump Tower? Same sentence?
Well, they are thinking about the map in a way that... you know, suggests that they're a little more cognizant of reality than they used to be, at least. But here's what's really weird. There was that great story today in Business Week about sort of inside the Trump campaign that gets at their data center in San Antonio, talks a lot about, that sort of dives deep into the campaign's analytics. And there was an interesting line in there where apparently on October 18th, the campaign had listed the following states as big targets for them. Ohio, okay, you know, he's winning there. It's an important one. Pennsylvania, he needs Pennsylvania, actually, even though he's not winning there and not doing well there. He needs it even if he wins Ohio, North Carolina, and Florida, the essentials. But then at the end of that list, Georgia. Georgia, you're worrying about Georgia and you're a Republican at this point? You know, why is that on your top states? And it goes to show just kind of there's a cockamamie feel to the way they approach the map and that they haven't really narrowed down or zeroed in on what's essential and what's not at this late stage.
I mean, to me, the most revealing line in that story, that Bloomberg Business Week story that you mentioned, is they have Trump's digital director, the guy who's running the operation out of San Antonio, who incidentally... going to make a whole lot of money off this. He's going to come out pretty well. All this talk about Trump making money off the campaign, maybe. But this guy, Brad Parscale, he's making money. He's making a lot of money off the campaign. He says, admits to the reporters Josh Green and or Sasha Eisenberg that they're running all these polls. They're running all these regular polls out of San Antonio, and they have, quote, similar results to what Nate Silver has. Well, Nate Silver has him losing badly. So, you know, I do think that there is actually a sense they do have a grasp of reality of what's going on at some level of the campaign, but maybe not so much in Trump Tower, or they're just spinning. Every campaign has to say that they think that they're going to win.
Yeah, I mean, in a fundraising email, you're not going to tell your supporters all is lost, forget it, even if they're not raising a ton of big dollar, you know, donations at this point.
We'll get to that in a minute.
But, you know, so part of it is just the typical BS that you see in these fundraising pitches and the overselling of this or that point to sort of manipulate, mass numbers of people into clicking donate. I was on the trail most of this week, just got back last night, and... you know, you can sort of see, I mean, Trump, a lot of what Trump does is sort of puffing himself up, making him feel good, spinning a narrative to explain away why things may not be going well as, you know, as far as the election's rigged, the media is a bunch of phonies, blah, 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 everything is terrible. And a lot of that is to like sort of set an explanation in place. And a lot of that also is as his campaign admits, to sort of depress turnout in some ways. I mean, he gave an entire speech supposedly about black outreach yesterday in Charlotte that I saw, and it was to a white audience, and all it was talking about how terrible everything is in African American communities. That they're willing to just say that, you know, call that what it is, which is an attempt to suppress the African American vote by sort of depressing, depressing turnout, but depressing the electorate and making them think that, like, you know, okay, we don't like Trump, but God, Democrats have been in charge of our cities for a long time, and boy, they sure haven't done it. That's Trump's point. That's what he's trying to do. But I think there was another interesting moment that I saw on Monday in North Florida. Trump at a rally, you know, for all Trump's sort of inability to grasp reality or to believe his own sort of insular, self-glorifying narrative, there are signs that he, too, knows that he's in trouble right
now.
And it's not just the whining and the complaining and everything is rigged. He was going through the polls, right? The entire campaign, Donald Trump has said at almost every rally, oh, we're winning, the polls have us up, everything is amazing. Well, at this rally on Monday in St. Augustine, he says, we're winning, you know, the polls are great. He names this one Investor's Business Daily poll, which is like basically all he's got at this point, and says that he's winning in that poll. Then he says, we're winning in Ohio, we're winning in Iowa, and we're doing very well in North Carolina. And it was telling because Iowa and Ohio, you know, when before we started these debates, those were the states that looked the swing states looked pretty clear that Trump was indeed winning. And now I think most, you know, forecasters see Clinton winning those states, but they're very close. Those are the closest. Those are the best two states for Trump of the so-called 10 swing states that we really consider tipping point states.
Yeah, the other thing that the other way in which I think you see some sense of reality sort of creeping in, even on Trump sort of stepping onto his hyperbole and his self-aggrandizing, is he started to say this back when I did a week on the trail late last month. He said, you know, I spent a lot of money on this campaign, and boy, will it have ended up being a waste if I don't win, and rhetoric like that, which is just so sort of, as you put it, like discordant to our ears, given what we've come to know and expect from Trump, and does suggest that, hey, he realizes things are not going well, and he is sort of thinking about what's next.
So I'm interested in turning back to North Carolina and some of these states. Now, CNN is perhaps the most bullish in terms of its polling, giving Clinton about 307 electoral votes. CNN has Ohio, Utah, Arizona, and North Carolina up for grabs. Charlie, when you're looking at the national polls versus the battleground state polls, are you seeing the same thing that this bullish CNN survey does?
Well, First off, I don't really pay that close attention to the national polls because you know my obsession here is just always making clear that we don't have a national race. We have a hardwired electoral map, and then we have 11 states where we have referendums that decide the presidency. When I look at the map, and I play with the 270 to win website, which is pretty cool, quite a bit to figure out what are the paths left to Donald Trump. And there's just not that many, even if you grant him all the states that you just mentioned, Kristen. So, for example, I assume that Donald Trump is going to win Iowa. I think when he says he's winning there, he's right. You know, the polling average has him ahead there. In Ohio, it's close enough. There are enough factors there. He's been in the lead enough of the campaign in Ohio that makes me think, like, okay, let's stipulate that he wins Ohio too. North Carolina, again, things aren't looking as good for him lately, but you could see, envision that. But here's the problem,
though. Can I just interject one thing, though?
No, but let me just finish this, and then you can tell me how it's BS. No, because this is just my theory. But if you add these up, you add up, give him Ohio, give him North Carolina, give him Florida, the essentials. He still doesn't get to 270. He still falls just short, and then he needs to get one more plus state. It's got to be Pennsylvania. It's got to be North Carolina. It has to be something to get him to 270.
Well, and we're assuming that he's going to win all these other red states. Right now, he may not win Utah, right? Evan McMullen, this person nobody's ever heard of, may win Utah. So that makes his math even more impossible. And the only point I was going to make was, you know, we're looking at these polls and we're saying, okay, well, right now, you know, he has a narrow advantage in Iowa, perhaps, which is a almost entirely white state, a good chance of maybe winning in Ohio. But the reality is these are really narrow margins right now. And who has a ground game? Clinton has 4-1 times the people that Trump has on the ground. And if that is worth a couple points on Election Day, we can look at turnout. We can look down, you know, like we're getting good information out of Florida. We're seeing where the votes are coming back. And it's a little bit of a mixed bag so far. And maybe some patterns will be clearer after another few days or after the weekend. But if the only states that Trump has a chance of winning right now in swing states are within a couple of points. Generally, I think the thought is the ground game, the Clinton ground operation is going to be worth 2 to 3 points on Election Day. And that may take these places where he says he's winning and the polls say he has a chance to win and put them in the Clinton column.
Well, if she can keep people focused on getting out of their houses or being late to work to actually show up to vote. And that is actually an issue right now. I know that that's what the people on the ground do. But what we're hearing from inside the Clinton campaign is that they're actually very nervous about the fact that most people think this is bait. We've got reporting from inside unions that shows them putting people, moving people from one state to another to go door knocking this weekend and next weekend because they are actually concerned that because everyone thinks the race is over, Democrats are not going to get the turnout they need. Are they lowering expectations or what is the game here? One of you.
Well, I definitely think that they are concerned about this and that they really have themselves to blame. I mean, they got so carried away with this talk about how it was going to be a wave election and she was going to be able to carry some Democratic candidates across the finish line and maybe even help Democrats retake the House. And they started talking about reallocating their resources, and the super PAC supporting her started talking about spending money more in some of these congressional races. And I think that that overconfidence did, you know, cause them to take their eye off the ball for you know, more than a minute. And you see them now furiously trying to sort of readjust and get rid of that sense. So you hear Hillary Clinton just yesterday in Florida talking about, don't be complacent just because the polls say that we're up. You know, we have to take this across the finish line and go hard and get your friends out to vote and all this stuff. And that's normal rhetoric. But I think that there is an added sense of urgency because they did give their supporters this sense of confidence that, hey, we got this. And now we're looking forward not just to helping Democrats in congressional races, but we're already looking forward to the transition and to the administration. That's dangerous.
And you have to worry about complacency in a race like this, which is looks much more like a blowout than any recent election we've had, presidential election. When you take a look at the bulk of national polls, many of which show a double-digit lead for Hillary Clinton, others which show high single digits. But then there's the other factor that was in that Business Week article we were talking about that I found really fascinating, the idea of the voter suppression efforts. First, I was shocked that they admitted that. You know, not that it doesn't go on, but you don't typically talk about that in a story like this. But their idea of voter suppression, too, it was that, you know, the people they wanted to suppress were African-Americans and young people, and especially young liberals. And it makes a lot of sense if because lots of folks, including me, have been scratching their heads at Trump's constant talk about the inner cities and how he's going to be great for African-Americans, and his talk about Bernie Sanders all the time. Well, now it makes a lot more sense. He is just trying to muddy the waters and maybe tamp down Democratic turnout from young liberals who were enamored of Bernie Sanders, or African-Americans who, you know, clearly from the polls have given Hillary Clinton a big margin. So I thought that was pretty fascinating in the article, that they readily admit that. And it explains why, for example, Donald Trump is making small radio buys aimed at African-American radio audiences.
And so telling on that point, Charlie, the Trump campaign, one of its big name recent hires is a guy by the name, he's not that big name, he's a big name for us sort of political obsessive, a guy by the name of Mike Roman. This guy was the head of the Koch brothers, what we call the Koch brothers intelligence unit, engaging in all the dark arts, you know, on behalf of the Kochs. But before that, he made his name putting out these Black Panther videos, the new Black Panther Party videos in Philadelphia, trying to basically like drum up evidence of voter fraud in the inner cities, where experts say there really isn't any. And so this guy's title is Chief Poll Watcher. But what that communicates to me is like they are really bullish on this idea that they can plant, that one of their strategies going down the stretch is going to be sowing doubts about the veracity of some of the election results in these inner cities. And that speaks to sort of what you're talking
about.
And I
would add that the radio ad that the Trump folks are running is, you know what they've pegged it to? Hillary Clinton's super predator remarks from the 1990s. They've got audio of her saying that, and that's what they're using.
And I think one of the reasons the Clinton campaign is nervous at this point, sitting on a huge lead. I mean, it's a good problem to have, right? Being nervous about your people thinking
lead.
That, you know, it's in the bag. I mean, I think, you know, she wouldn't have that problem if she were running against Marco Rubio or somebody else. So I think all things being equal, they're fine in Brooklyn. But I think one of the reasons that this is nervous at this point is that Trump's campaign is such an asymmetrical threat, and they do things and are willing to go places that other campaigns, more conventional candidates, won't go. And so once Trump started to lose, what did he do? He just started trashing Bill Clinton and his legacy. I mean, you know, we were sitting there going to a mystery campaign event that was on the schedule on Tuesday morning in Doral, Florida, and nobody knew what it was. And there was serious chatter on the press bus that they were going to trot out Danny Williams, the alleged, you know, African-American offspring of former President Clinton. So nobody knows what this campaign is going to do. And I think that makes it sort of a little wild and woolly for Hillary Clinton and her people. And what Ken and Charlie are talking about, I think, is exactly, you know, testament to that.
You talk about the asymmetric threat. I mean, a little teaser for the listeners. I'm so excited about next week's show because we've just gone out and commissioned a great study that might show us something that we've been talking about for weeks and weeks and weeks, and that is whether there really is a shy Trump voter out there. Is there a person who will not tell pollsters they are going to vote for Trump, but completely plans to vote for Trump? So,
but before we go to the next segment, can we just talk for a second about how Trump's data operation or his database is nicknamed Project Alamo? I mean, that's
Project Chernobyl wasn't available.
All right, let's get to the next data point. It is zero. That's the number of fundraisers planned for Trump victory. That's the Joint Fundraising Committee comprised of the Trump campaign and the RNC between October the 19th and Election Day. Now, Ken, is this some kind of parting shot at the RNC, which is truly the only organization that has steadfastly stood behind Donald?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough not to see it that way to some extent. The Trump campaign was totally reliant on the Republican National Committee for its ground game, for its data, for really all the nuts and bolts of the campaign that it largely eschewed during the primary, that Trump largely eschewed during the primary. So Trump didn't have a campaign. He needed the RNC to kind of be his campaign in waiting and his fundraising operation in waiting. It tried to do that. And that, you know, we wrote all these stories early in the general election about this uneasy detente between the RNC and the Trump campaign. And the Trump campaign was suspicious of the RNC that it wasn't doing all that it could be doing to help him raise money. And so, you know, ultimately they did mount a somewhat successful fundraising effort. I think it was deeply flawed in that it relied too much on big checks that the Trump campaign itself could not access, only could access like a tiny fraction of the money that was being raised by this Trump victory. And most of it was, in fact, going to the RNC. That really inflamed some of these suspicions among the Trump folks that they were getting taken advantage of. And here you have them down the stretch saying, no mas, we're done with the RNC. We're going to keep raising money online, small donations through that Trump victory fund. Technically, some of that money could go to the RNC, but it tends to be smaller dollar donations, most of which will go to the Trump campaign. And so I do see it as the sort of final parting shot of Trump versus the RNC.
I mean, in terms of practical effects here, we were just talking about the field operations, right? And the trying to find, potentially, if they exist, trying to find these shy Trump voters. The money, like any money not flowing into the RNC, which is in charge of the field operations for Trump and other portions of the Republican Party at this point, is, you know, that's fewer door knocks, that's fewer phone calls, fewer pieces of mail trying to find these people and drag them out. And, you know, there's been a lot of research on why Democrats spend so much time doing this, why the Obama campaign did this, and why Clinton has adopted these tactics, that the best way to get an unlikely voter to become a likely voter is to talk to them and have a one-on-one interaction. If you get them to, say, fill out a card and then, you know, promising to vote and then mail it back to them a week or two before Election Day, that's a really persuasive tactic that Democratic groups use a lot. But, you know, again, the less money that's flowing into this, the less of that they can do.
Yeah, and this really does represent to an extent the Trump campaign sort of shooting itself in the foot here, because its fundraising has just so far lagged behind Hillary Clinton's. Hillary Clinton has raised about $500 million through the end of last month compared to $219 million for Trump. So less than half as much brought in by the Trump campaign. The RNC, on the other hand, has done pretty well. They've recorded themselves well. They've actually outraised the DNC so far this cycle. And they have put a lot of resources into the ground game, even as we like to, you know, look for ways in which the ground game is deficient. You know, they have made great strides, I think, in their ground game, and Trump needs their ground game. And the less money that goes into the RNC down the stretch, the less money that they have to allocate towards that ground game.
And just one more point on this front. Charlie mentioned that New York Times upshot poll of Pennsylvania, where Clinton's up by 7. There's a little fascinating tidbit buried in there that, you know, kind of getting to this question of unlikely voters and, you know, the Trump's appeal to white voters and the white voters who didn't vote in 2012 but are likely to vote in 2016 in Pennsylvania, according to this poll, are actually breaking for Clinton.
And just one more point of contrast on that. I mean, the Hillary Clinton campaign still continues to work very closely with the DNC. This Hillary Victory Fund, which is their big money vehicle, has had unprecedented success at raising money. And the Clinton campaign is doing 40, while the Trump campaign is doing zero fundraisers down the stretch, basically from here. She's got 40 fundraisers scheduled. She's not doing them, but guess who is? It's Cher. Jay-Z, Jennifer Lopez. So Hillary from the block will be just fine in the money race down the stretch.
Well, maybe Trump can find Scott Baio and send him out to do a couple of things. But I think, you know, one of the things that we remember a couple of weeks ago, we talked about Trump's claim that he was unshackled now after the first debate, and it didn't, you know, and things were getting away from him. And he's, I'm just going to do this my way. Well, you know, a lot of Ken's reporting, our reporting for months has been about this uneasy relationship with the RNC and Trump's reluctance to actually do the big, you know, the heavy lifting that these fundraising things require. He's always just preferred going out and doing the rallies and getting on his airplane and watching himself on TV. And I think part of the unshackling and the sort of liberation of Trump at the end is from him saying, screw it. I'm not doing that anymore. I'm doing this, the last part of the campaign, I'm doing it my way. And that means, I mean, he's on the trail bragging about how many rallies he does every day. And so, oh, Hillary Clinton just goes home and goes to sleep. I'm out here doing six events a day. He's sort of, you know, using that as like, look how hard I'm working. But these rallies, just like the fundraisers, are not things that sort of gratify his own ego because he's asking other people for money and sucking up to other people, which he doesn't like to do. The rallies are for Trump and for Trump's ego and to bathe himself in the adulation several times a day. That's where we are at the end of the campaign. And that's a big reason, I think, why at the end of this, he's just said, screw it. I'm not going into the room anymore and shaking hands with the rich
people.
Eli,
spend a minute telling the listeners about being on the trail in this moment with this candidate.
Oh, it's roughly the same as it's been being on the trail in this moment with this candidate all along, with the exception that the anger and the outrage, is at some moments, not all the time, but at some moments, really sort of at a sort of, you know, thicker froth and higher, the volume is louder, and that you can just feel more vitriol in, you know, from some of these crowds, because he's really now leaning into the idea that everything is rigged. And that the media, I mean, he's just railing against everybody. The other day, it was like he read The Catcher in the Rye, because he was referring to everyone as phonies. Hillary Clinton's a phony. Barack Obama's a phony. The media's phony. Even the media's cameras are phony, he said. And I don't know how a camera can be phony unless it's like a toy that doesn't work. But just so angry and bitter. And that's reflected in a lot of these crowds, because they sit and they're right on top of the press pen where everybody is all fenced in. And we sit there. And Trump will you know, go through his thing about, you know, these press are so dishonest, some of the most despicable people in the world. They've got all these cameras. They never show the crowds right. He's always bitter because nobody's showing his crowd. And you have all these people around who are, you know, sort of hanging on every word he says, and then sort of almost controlled and yelling it back. So he'll say, they never turn the cameras, and you'll have, you know, people right on the edge of the press pen turn and shout at us, turn the damn cameras. You know, they're like, you know, crazy. And there are, I mean, there's a lot of people, I mean, there are a lot of network correspondents and even embeds who are traveling with their own security now. The networks have hired their own security, not Secret Service, not Trump security, their own security to go with the correspondent in and out of the rallies.
This is truly an extraordinary election cycle.
You know, the one point
of what they're seeing from the crowd.
I got a raise is, I understand. I spent some time on the Trump campaign. Yeah, that sort of anger is there, and it is directed at the press.
And it's been there all along.
And it is, done in a way that is uncomfortable, but I don't think it's quite as new as some of the 22-year-old embeds on the trail who've never covered a presidential campaign would have one believe. You know, I remember covering Sarah Palin and spending quite a bit of time with her down the stretch of the 2008 campaign. And in many ways, a lot of, you know, folks have suggested she was Trump before Trump. She had like an amazing ability to channel that anger in the conservative base towards the elite institutions of American life, including the media, in a way that the Secret Service had to like personally intervene, step between me and someone who was like screaming at me and pointing at me and clear a path to usher me through. You know, I spent only a week with the Trump campaign. Maybe that would have happened. It didn't. So I think we have to be careful about suggesting that it's entirely unprecedented for a conservative politician to rile the base by directing vehement energy at the vehement anger.
I think
anger
there
at
is
the
no argument you can make, Ken, that this election season is like other election seasons in the level of aggressive language, threats of violence. I mean, the Palin campaign was one thing. This has taken the Palin campaign and the level of vitriol around it, both in the rhetoric and in the action by the supporters on the ground, and taken it up a notch.
Yeah, Sarah Palin was an antecedent to Donald Trump, I think. But there's no question that
we didn't have Twitter back then. It wasn't like quite as the frenetic energy around the campaign as a whole was a lot less, but if you could actually see it on the ground, which I did, I think that like it was not dissimilar from the actual crowds, the people on the ground outside the bubble who are not on Twitter, maybe.
I would say Ken has a point in that there is a lot of overlap, and that some of this we've seen before. I just don't know that we've seen it at the same level when you have people out there referring to the press as Lugan press, right? The very loaded anti-Semitic. I mean, there are certain things that are said, and there's a sort of, I think Trump has made it okay for some people who harbor certain sentiments to just sort of verbalize them. And I think, and beyond that, to act on these sort of more violent impulses, which is something that maybe we didn't see from Sarah Palin, who would complain and criticize and sort of gin up anger at the mainstream media. Yeah, that was there. But this is, I don't know that there were campaign reporters in 2008 walking around with their own personal security detail, or getting quite the level of anti-Semitic emails and tweets and threats that
right,
we're seeing right now.
Tweets again. That's we keep coming back to this. A lot of this anger that we see, a lot of this anti-Semitism is on Twitter. I think Twitter is new.
But it's
anger and the energy directed towards the press.
I've been on the trail most of the last month, though. I'm just telling you that it's not just limited to Twitter.
All right. So clearly the vitriol on the campaign makes its way into Nerdcast. Let's get back on track here. Another data point, $6.6 billion. That's the amount that the Center for Responsive Politics predicts will be spent on the 2016 federal election. Now, look, that's higher than the last presidential, but it really reflects a slower rate of spending growth here. This is not what we were supposed to see in 2016, Ken. I think the answer is probably obvious, Donald Trump.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we came into this cycle thinking that this was going to be the first cycle, the first like real cycle of the Citizens United era in which all candidates on both sides of the aisle really embraced big money, relied on super PACs to power their campaign, as opposed to the traditional route of raising these smaller hard dollar contributions. And what we saw on both sides was that logic did not, or there were certainly candidates who tried to pursue that course, but it did not really carry the day. Bernie Sanders obviously gave Hillary an extremely vigorous challenge without a super PAC, as we know, relying on donations that averaged $27. And on the other side, Donald Trump didn't have a super PAC until late in the game. And to the extent that he has a super PAC supporting him now, they're kind of just, you know, shells of what they could have been under another candidate, like a Jeb Bush, for instance, who did have the really robust super PAC that raised more than $100 million. A lot of good that did him. So I think we're seeing a lot of folks who were really worried that the big money would carry the day and money would equal votes and power and this would be the billionaire's election. They're rethinking that and wondering, you know, in some ways wondering if maybe things aren't as bad as they thought that they were. In other ways, they're looking for outrage in other places, including congressional races, where super PACs are that much more significant. But just the fact that they are was not enough to, like you said, continue the rate of growth the Center for Responsive Politics predicts that this election will cost $86.5 million more than the 2012 election. Well, that's a whole lot of a smaller growth rate than we saw from 2008 to 2012 or from 2004 to 2008. So something's happening here. Not exactly sure what it is, but it's definitely worth watching.
I was interested to see that the Steyer clan has really spent the most, topping out at something like $57 million.
Yeah, that's right. And they say they are unabashedly talking about how they are trying to mimic the Koch brothers' blueprint. And what's so interesting about that is the Koch brothers are among the folks who were sort of most chastened in this election cycle. As we wrote today, they've really scaled back their spending and their operation. They were seen as like at the vanguard of privatizing politics and creating a private political party that took advantage of this new big money type of spending. Well, they didn't get their way. They basically admitted in this meeting that we wrote about that they've had, quote, very little success in shaping elections or policy fights or even the grassroots energy around the conservative base. So, you know, it's even internally, it's not just us looking at it from the outside and saying big money hasn't worked. It's the folks who are actually raising and spending the biggest money admitting it's not working.
I want to circle back to Steyer for a second, though, because there's an interesting little side thing about the massive amounts of money he's pumped into the election. And he and his group, Next Gen Climate, they're doing things all over the country. But among the things that they've done this year is they've done a big voter registration drive and a bunch of TV ads in California featuring Tom Steyer himself, who is a big,
Governor
big mega
Steyer?
Donor, but who no one knows and is thinking about running for governor in 2018. And so he's in these TV ads talking, you know, and it says, I'm Tom Steyer, and it has his name on there, and he's been running them on Spanish language TV in LA and like different places around the state, you know, and there's really no reason that he would be in these except to try and boost his name recognition
he's doing these little like ads and videos targeted to other places around the country, including one with Aziz Ansari and Ben Affleck, and the Ben Affleck one is targeted towards New Hampshire. It's actually pretty funny, Ben Affleck, because we all know.
Is it on TV, though?
I don't know if it's on TV or
just
online.
That was the striking thing about the California ads. Like, some of them were, Tom Steyer was on TV, like, standing in front of, you know, a backdrop of multiracial children and, you know, just talking about the future of California and stuff. And don't get me wrong, like, some of this voter registration stuff could pay big dividends in some of the House races there this year and so on and so forth. But it definitely seems like there's a little bit more. In fact, there are a number of potential future governors of California who are using ballot measures and their own PACs and whatever to be on TV this year in advance of that.
All right, let's stick with this down ballot effect and talk about our final data point, the number three, Scott. That's the number of Republican House incumbents whose seats are now characterized as lean D or even worse in the Cook Political Report. Now, Scott, for all the talk of a Democratic wave, this is a surprisingly small number. It's fascinating, actually. What is Trump doing to the House map?
Yeah, it's really interesting, and we actually just took a big look at it earlier this week. But basically, what we've seen is, as you know, Trump's numbers have declined and Clinton's have improved nationwide. A whole bunch of new House seats in some pretty unexpected places have suddenly turned into battlegrounds. You know, Montana's statewide at large House seat, Southern Indiana. You know, there's money pouring into a more rural district in Colorado, and you know, just a few other places around the country where that were really not on the radar earlier. But at the same time, as you know, some of these more Republican-leaning districts have kind of shifted into battleground territory, we haven't seen very many at all of the initial battleground districts shift into Democratic territory. Just the number of battlegrounds has expanded. And this is actually very frustrating for Democratic strategists who had hoped that they would have put a few races away at this point. The result is that they're still continuing to pump money into some of these races, you know, in Nevada, in Chicago, in a few other places around the country that, you know, where the electorate leans Democratic, but some of the incumbents, the Republican incumbents, have actually done a pretty good job separating themselves from Trump so far. And so they're still pouring a ton of money into those races, even as they're trying to scrounge up the cash to also expand the map into Montana and these far-flung House districts to try and expand things a little bit.
And it's so notable when House members or candidates are able to like separate themselves from the national trend. I mean, we talk about like for Senate candidates, it's a lot easier. Senators especially, you know, they sort of develop an identity of their own and they're not as linked to the party nationally. And so they can more successfully run against or separate themselves from the top of the ticket. So much harder with the House race. And that's why we look, Charlie talks about, you know, national polls being not super useful, but that's why we look at national polls for the presidency when we think about like the effect on House races in particular. So the smart pollsters who we talk to, our colleague Steve Shepard wrote a story about this, I think it was Steve, pointing out that a lot of the pollsters think that if there's a 6-point lead for Hillary Clinton in national polls, that gives Democrats a legit but sort of long shot at winning back the House, while an 8-point lead for Hillary Clinton would really put the House in play. Well, depending on which poll you look at right now, we're closer to 6, I think, than we are to 8. We might be right in that middle ground, so it doesn't necessarily look great as far as the prospects of a wave actually flipping control of the House.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm sort of afraid Ken will jump over the table and strangle me here. No, I'm a kind of a contrarian on this, the idea that the House is in play. I mean, it's 30 seats that Democrats need to win. That is a ton. That is a big wave. And we just don't see tons of indications of a big wave. I mean, first of all, I disagree with the idea that an 8-point Hillary Clinton win could threaten the House majority. I think it's got to be double digits, probably closer to 12 or 14 for Dems to get to about 30 House seats. I don't see that happening. I don't see enough indications of it happening in enough districts. I do think, you know, it's going to be a rough year for Republicans in the House. They will lose probably double digit House seats, but getting to 30 is another matter entirely just because of the way the House is drawn now, the way it's been gerrymandered. I mean, there's not a lot of low hanging fruit left. I mean, they were pretty much picked off in recent elections. And I think, you know, what you'll see, my guess is that the Trump effect will be assuming the polls are right and Hillary Clinton wins pretty comfortably, but not like a 12, 14 point blowout, what you'll see is there will be suburban Republicans in areas with high percentages of college graduates. Those will be the most endangered Republicans. Here we're talking about places like the seat in the Minneapolis suburbs, Philly suburbs, places like that, Southern California, a couple of Republicans there are going to get picked off. But at the same time, one thing that doesn't get talked about a lot, and Scott, you know, you're the genius on this. Interested in your perspective is what doesn't get talked about a lot is the positive Trump effect. There will be some rural districts where he helps. He's going to help in Minnesota 8, which is that Iron Range district. And I think he's going to help in a lot of the rural areas in the upper Mississippi River Valley that haven't really gone Republican in the same way that rural and small town America has gone Republican elsewhere. Maybe Maine's second congressional district, which is the northern one. So I think you'll see a couple of those. And I think ultimately, while he won't be a net plus Trump, I don't think at this point, based on everything I can see, and it could change in the next 12 days, but at this point, I don't see enough out there that will cost the Republicans the House.
Yeah, I think to your point also, some of those upstate New York districts also around where our caller and where I'm from are, you know, kind of among the type that Republicans won in the 2010 wave, and Trump may actually be helping them keep it this time around, as opposed to hurting like he is in some of these suburban places. One thing I will say though is, you know, the even though only three House incumbents, like we said, are rated by Cook as more likely than not to lose at this point, the number of toss-ups is big and keeps growing. They've got 17 Republican-held seats as toss-ups right now, and that keeps growing. And I think just one of the things, you know, I don't know if there's a lot of talk always, like before pretty much every election we have now, is like, what is a wave? What constitutes a wave? Something like that. And I think ultimately, you know, I don't know if it has to be flipping control of the House or just big gains or what, but one of the things that strikes me about thinking about past wave elections is that we don't remember the percentages all that much. We just remember the results. We remember that Democrats took the Senate in 2006. We don't remember, most of us, that John Tester barely won to give them the Senate, right? And so I think there very well could be a lot of these Republican House members who are toss-ups who end up losing by the barest of margins, partly because even though they're been able to separate themselves to some extent from Trump, House Democrats are pouring a ton of money into trying to tie them together. In fact, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee is doing something weird, and we haven't entirely been able to figure out what it is, but they are directing hundreds of thousands of dollars directly to congressional campaigns, far above the usual coordinated campaign expenditure limits, to help them run TV ad tying their the local Republican candidates to Donald Trump. And we haven't been able to get them to tell us exactly what their legal reasoning is for the campaign finance move that they're making there, but they are pouring a ton of money into this.
Well, you can be sure that the Federal Election Commission will look into it closely and quickly and come out with a very stern ruling if they find that it runs afoul of the coordination limits. Psych.
Those people can see Ken's face right now.
The story in the Senate, though, is completely different. $25 million is how much the Senate GOP's main super PAC is now pouring into six races in these final 12 days to save their majority. Scott, do the Democrats take the Senate?
I think so. I think it's more likely than not at this point. Again, when you've got so many of these races balanced on a knife edge, I think you have to kind of give the tie to the party that is having a better year, which is the Democrats. But it's going to be certainly a lot closer than some Democrats expected. You know, they again, apart from Illinois and Wisconsin, they have not really put any battleground races away. And, you know, so they're still very hard fought. They've brought North Carolina and Missouri online, and those are now among the most tightly contested battleground races. But they haven't really put any of those states that they were contesting away besides Illinois and Wisconsin, which really tilted Democratic the whole year.
I'm with Scott on this. I think my answer would be the same, more likely than not. And here's where I agree with Ken. But if it's a 6-point or 6-point plus Hillary Clinton win, definitely. It's really hard for me to see how Republicans hold the Senate if she's up at 6 points or above, based on past history and what we know from the correlation there. But here's the other thing that I've been thinking about a lot. So obviously Senate control matters a great deal, but the effect of a Republican takeover will be devastating. I'm sorry, of a Democratic takeover of the Senate will be devastating for reasons other than the power balance in Washington. Because if Democrats win control of the Senate, it's going to be because they swept in a very large class of Democratic women, including, you know, whether you're talking about Kamala Harris in California, Masto in Nevada, Duckworth in Illinois,
or Sanchez
Hassan,
in California.
Yeah, assuming that long shot comes in, the North Carolina race. So you're going to have a very big class of Democratic women. It also is going to mean that some of the Republican Party's biggest rising stars are going to have to be cleaned out in that loss, like one of the few prominent national Hispanic Republicans they have, Marco Rubio. Kelly Ayotte would go down under that scenario. So you're cleaning out some of the top talent, Republican talent that would be on the national scene for decades otherwise. So you're cleaning that whole thing out, and you're also underscoring the Democratic argument and all of the weakness Republicans have in being perceived as the party of the old stuffy party of white guys. I mean, so just from a symbolic value, it would be devastating as well.
And, you know, having said that, it is easier for senators to run against the top of the ticket or separate themselves from the top of the ticket. There's even a limit to that, though. You can only run so far ahead of the top of the ticket, and we really see that being tested with folks like Rubio in Florida, who does have a healthy lead. But if Trump loses badly in Florida, probably won't lose badly, probably be close. But if he does, it would be just really difficult to imagine Rubio, even as he has tried to separate himself from Trump, not just going back to their actual primary against each other in the presidential, but since then not appearing on stage with him at his rally recently in Florida, and really keeping his distance rhetorically. It does call to mind, our colleague Alex Eisenstadt wrote about this recently, the 1996 Bob Dole strategy, where Bob Dole was going to lose, and Republicans sort of separated themselves from him, and the Republican Party separated itself from him and allocated more resources down ballot. The difference between that and this is, sure, Bob Dole was losing, but he was not so incredibly unpopular as Donald Trump is, A. And B, Bob Dole was like, okay, look, this is what's happening. It's a shame. But like, for the good of the party, I'm not going to challenge this. Trump, every time you see the party or any of its Senate candidates sort of stepping away from him, jumps on them and heaps scorn on them, making it that much more difficult to implement this strategy.
And here's another big difference between the Trump example and the Dole example. Dole was a complete team player. You know, he was an institutionalist. He was somebody who had chaired the Republican Party. He cared deeply about the party. This was the party he was a part of for decades. And so he was going to bite the bullet and wanted his party to end up in a better position than he was once he realized what was happening. Now, think about Trump on the other hand. He doesn't care at all. In fact, his post-presidential race success in many ways is predicated on blowing up the Republican Party and starting an alternative either TV network or party. And he's already said he could care less about anyone, whether it's Paul Ryan or the rest of the ticket or all the other people that he believes has wronged him, many of whom are in the Senate or running for re-election or whatever. So he doesn't care at all. He's perfectly willing to burn it all down.
That's it for us. Goodbye, Charlie.
Bye, Kristen.
Adios, Scott.
Until next time.
Ken, thank you.
Fun time. As always.
Eli, go back to work.
See ya.
Thank you to our executive producer, Bridget Mulcahy, and our researcher and Politico web producer, Zach Montalaro. Thanks to our illustrator, Bill Cookman. Also, join us in sending good, healthy vibes to Matt Sobosinski, who leads our multimedia team here at Politico. Get well, Matt. And of course, thank you to our listeners. Talk to you next week. We really love doing this podcast, and we love hearing from you. So please keep sending emails to nerdcast@politico.com and subscribe to us on iTunes and rate us. We're also on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. And while you're there, please check out Glenn Thrush's great podcast, Off Message.